Welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. Scott Linden here. Glad you could join me. Oh boy, I can't wait. This will be a fun one. I am welcoming to the show Lieutenant Colonel, retired, Dave Grossman. Dave is one of the three authors of a book that I'm fascinated with, simply called On Hunting. The subtitle is What Got Me, a definitive study of the mind, the body, and the ecology of the hunter in the modern world. Man, if you want to learn more about why we really go or should go and stay going, Dave will have the answers, I am just confident. But that's not all on the docket for today. Our Handle It segment, I'll share a tidbit that I took away from a talk with Ronnie Smith and Susanna Love on dog training. And it will open your eyes a little bit as well. And then, well, recently at Pheasant Fest, more to say on that as the weeks go on. But it reminded me that I'd asked on social media about your best hunt of the season and why it was the best. So stand by for all of that right here on the Upland Nation podcast, made possible by Sage and Breaker Gun Care Products, Pointer Shotguns, Mid-Valley Clays and Shooting School, TruLock Choke Tubes, MidwayUSA.com, Purina Pro Plan Sport, Dog Food, LandTrust.com, ESPAmerica.com, and High Viz Shooting Systems. Still coping. In fact, it was funny. It was almost balmy in Sioux Falls, South Dakota for the Pheasant Fest. And what did I come home to? Sub-zero temperatures and a couple inches of snow that has just piled up and piled up. Starting to melt, but we are regretting the lack of activity, travel, injuries, etc. So what are we doing around here? We're trying to get out and get some longer conditioning runs in for Flick and some longer workouts for me too. Now, I don't run alongside him. My knees won't let me do that, but I am working out harder and both of us are getting longer runs in the backyard. Getting in shape for the next season right now, and believe me, Flick is very happy. But for you, I thought I'd finally ask the ultimate question. You've had time to dwell on it for a while. I heard some great stories at Pheasant Fest. What is the high point of your last hunting season and why was it so? Some fascinating reasons or rationale. Jeremy Jones says, seeing the light bulb come on for my three-year-old short hair. Yeah, you know, a lot of people would think, well, that's a little late. No, it is not. I'm still thinking Flick has some maturing to do. Good for you, Jeremy, and for your dog. Lots of nice coveys for Tom Hurst. Yeah, it was a good year, wasn't it? Hanging with good friends is what Dirty Point Kennels has to say, and he's not alone. Didn't break an ankle stepping in a foxhole for Pete Wettergreen. Yeah, I like that. He's got a great picture Mark Cross does of two short hairs and looks like a limit of Kansas pheasants. Yeah, because there's four of them. Mark says, watching these two become wild bird experts. Isn't that the truth? Lovely story from Kevin Biggs, Montana, with my son and our dogs. Three beautiful dogs on the tailgate with a limit or so of birds. Good looking limit. In fact, I hope you had a lot of fun out there. My oldest dog holding firm with a grouse strutting 10 feet away with fan proudly displayed. Yeah, that's what Mike LaRue is grateful for, and that's what comes up in conversation at the tavern, I bet. Puppy pointing is first wild bird. Ted Wentink, congratulations to you. Wentink, sorry, Ted. Pheasant retrieved from 190 yards in heavy cover for George Shea. Wow. Longest we got was a 476-yard point. I had to slog all the way over to through two little canyons to get there. That, now that I think about it, that might have been my highlight. Good boy, Flick. Yeah. The bird flew wild before I could push it, but I did hit it, so I consider that a victory. Scott Bissiger says, hunting with my kids and grandsons. I've waited a lot of years for that. Had that conversation with a good friend last night. Let's hope that he makes a hunter of his grandson as well. So lots of incredible stories out there. Grandson and in-laws, wild chucker. That's quite a mix. Gordon Vavreck, glad to see that. Travis Powers, Montana grouse with a 13-year-old rescue dog. What a great story. And a beautiful picture, by the way. Yeah, you can see the gray in his muzzle, even though he's really kind of a white, and I think you guys call it lemon. It might be orange, but good old setter there in the grouse woods. Yeah, there are so many. If you haven't contributed yet, now is the time. Just go to any of the social media and answer that question. We'll probably touch on that one or two more times over the year. It is always fun and motivating. So keep up the good work, everybody. Glad you've all had a great season. That part of the show is brought to you by ProPlan Sport Performance from Purina. You know, I got to spend some time in the Purina booth while I was at Pheasant Fest, and what amazed me is how many knowledgeable experts they had in the booth and all the great conversations between them and dog owners, grouse, pheasant, quail hunters, it didn't matter. We even had a few service dogs and some sled pulling dogs that were walking around out there. These folks know their stuff. They got staff of expert trainers, nutritionists, veterinarians, all pulling for ProPlan formulations that will help your dog become a better hunter. Not just the food either. Fortiflora, that probiotic, and all their other products are carefully researched, tested, and quality controlled, and that's why I like them. ProPlansport.com is where you learn more about them. ProPlansport.com. And thanks for hosting me, everybody, at Pointer Shotguns. That's where I did all my Pheasant Fest podcast interviews you'll be hearing very soon. We had a great time. It was kind of funny because we were right there in the booth and everybody wanted to say hello and then walk right around me and take a look at those great Pointer Shotguns. I'll tell you, for a subtle, artful bluing that includes case coloring, it sure stood out. Everybody was mounting those guns, including the over and under 28 gauges. If you're looking for a new shotgun, remember one thing, 7-year warranty. Yeah, youth models, you name it, they've got it. Find a dealer, find a price, find a model you like at pointershotguns.com. Well, here at the Upland Nation podcast, we talk about a lot of things, some practical, some less than practical, but just as important, and that's the topic today. One of the co-authors, the lead author of the book called On Hunting, A Definitive Study of the Mind, Body, and Ecology of the Hunter in the Modern World. That author is Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman. And he is here to kind of take us, you know, a little bit down a rabbit hole that we all kind of allude to, but we never get to completely, and that is ourselves and how we relate to this fascinating pastime that some people call a hobby, some people call a passion. Dave Grossman, welcome to the Upland Nation podcast.
Hello, Scott. So good to be on board with you. And some of your listeners may know, I've got two books that have been the Marine Corps Commandant's required reading list for over 20 years of war.
Wow.
Some may know my book on killing. They may know my book on combat. Actually, I have a book called On Spiritual Combat. But this is a book I've wanted to write for an awful long time. You can't understand the killing. You can't understand combat without understanding hunting. It is so primary to who we are and what we do. We say in the book, you know, take an evolutionary perspective, respect all perspectives, but from that evolutionary perspective, if our species had been in existence for 24 hours, up until the last 6 minutes, all we did was hunt.
Yeah.
That's what we're made to do. And of course, we talk about that in the book, and we really dig into dynamics on, you know, articulating who we are and why we do this to get this deeper understanding. I'm 67 years old. I know a lot of your listeners, we're here in the prime of our life. I'm still in my prime, 67, but we've got this thing in our head about passing on our passion to the next generation and being able to defend it and articulate what we do. And that's kind of, to a large degree, what that book was about. It, you know, we talk in the book about the fact that we have the forward-set eyes of a predator. We have the gripping fangs of a predator. But we also have the chiseled teeth of a rabbit and the grinding molars of a grass eater. And throughout the history of our species, we've been in the middle of the food chain. And we talk early on in the book about how the British government reports that in India from 1900 to 1910, over that decade, over 100,000 people were killed by tigers. So we were in the middle of the food chain, but it's no fun being prey. We want to be predator. We are exercising our predator genes. It is so incredibly rewarding. And of course, so much more. But just jumping in the deep end about the book, and thank you for your kind words. And does that all make sense from your perspective, Scott?
Yeah, it does, because it changes one's perspective. It's fascinating how you immediately got to the crux of one of the matters we'll talk about, and that is, first off, we probably wouldn't be here as a race such as we are today, without hunting. And then the key to that all, though, I think for us is why propels us in that world? What do we get out of it now when we don't really have to do it? And there's a whole bunch of people who don't think we should. We should go get our meat from the grocery store instead of going out and killing it. So give us a little ammo, pardon the pun.
Amen. Well, first off, we are daylight sight hunters. And dogs are daylight sight hunters. And our relationship with dogs have been across untold tens of thousands of years. And to a certain degree, we love to hunt for the same reason the dog does. Those same genes, the hunting genes, the thrill of the hunt, the thrill of the chase. A lot of people would say, the only reason I hunt is to keep my dog happy. Because the dog is my reason to get out there. The beauty of the dog work and everything goes with it. And so many people, if you've never been there, you can't even begin to understand the power and the beauty and the team that works together. But we've got to realize, just take a minute, it's good to say, I generally do it now for my dog, but we need to understand there's a little piece inside of us that is exactly the same as that dog. And is equally gratified and equally satisfied to go out there as a team and to hunt our food, And we talk about in the book that killing is necessary. Your body right now is killing millions of microorganisms. If you don't do it, you die. And people say, I'm a vegetarian. Well, we have to exterminate billions of rats and mice around the grain elevators around the world every year. If we did not exterminate billions of rats and mice, they would get in the grain storage. They would reproduce exponentially, and we would all starve.
Even the vegetarians.
For you to have your loaf of bread, billions of rats and mice had to die. And to live is to kill. Let us harvest our own protein. And don't think that you're superior. We don't stop you from doing your life. And they really have no place to stop us from doing what we do. But we talk in the book as well about the contribution that the sportsman makes. When we have our hunting license, when we get our deer tags and all the other stuff that goes with it, where's that money go? And of course, so much we've got pheasants forever and ducks unlimited and all of the vast amounts of money. So how if you disagree with my hunting, how much money did you put into the natural wildlife preservation? How much money did you contribute to DNR, the Department of Natural Resources last year? We really can stand and in a rational way defend what we do. Both as something deeply and profoundly satisfying. And I hope the words in there give us something for us to hang on to. And so many of us, it's about articulating, and we're not all that good necessarily. But if somebody tries to gather all the info together, puts it in a form that allows us to articulate and then to pass it on to that next generation, really, really, that's the goal of this book, is to explore all those aspects of hunting, historically, and as a species, and the gratification of being in nature. Is such a powerful and beautiful thing for us to be able to wrap our mind around and to be a part of. Does that kind of make sense?
It does, and a lot of us, in fact, just coming back from Pheasant Fest a few weeks back, it's still top of mind with me at how many people are, kind of disappointed in the way things may be going from a regulatory or a conservation agency's point of view or whatever, and they're looking for a little bit more motivation and knowledge. And you touched on something that I think is really important there. And that is that we need to understand better what we do and why we do it. Let's talk about the why of that just a little bit more. You go deep into it in the book. What's the takeaway for us on, we've talked about what I'll loosely call the genetic background, but what happens to us on a day-to-day basis when we come back from a hunting trip that makes us a better person?
I'm a huge science geek. My favorite website is Science Daily. Check through every category, and there's an enormous amount of research on the value of trees and parks and wilderness. One major study of happiness, and they looked at like millions of little Twitter feeds, and they looked for words like happiness and joy and satisfaction and the words that it related to. What they found was that parks and wilderness and outside was the single greatest gratification, satisfaction anybody would have. The dynamics on it, it's the only thing that compared to getting out in the woods, the only thing that compared to it was Christmas. It's like every day in the woods is like Christmas.
Well, by the way, there's a tree involved in that too.
Yes, exactly. That's a good point. You got a point there. What do we do? Oh, that is so good. You just put a round in my magazine. We're going to run with that. What do we do at Christmas?
Okay,
we
bring a feel tree free to use that.
It gives us joy. I think the first thing we got to realize is just the intense and incredible satisfaction that comes with that. Your blood pressure goes down, your basic body regulatory factors rise to a healthy point. We're outside, we're getting a decent walk. We tease the golfers and we tell them, golf is a golf course. It's a willful and deliberate misuse of a perfectly good rifle range, but the golf course would also make an awful good upland bird preserve, and far more than you would get from golfing. You've got all of that included, plus, as you say, it's not to be diminished, to bring home the fruits of your labor and to pass that on to the young generation. My dad and I, we've pheasant hunted many times across the years, and what an experience. Stories we can tell, the time that we spent around the campfire cleaning the pheasant and the salt and pepper and cook them right there over the campfire and share little bits with the dog. And just a deep satisfaction. My wife now, my bride of 48 years, just a few months before 49 years, she was 15. I was 17 when I proposed to her. We tell people we are from Arkansas. 2 years later, she married a crazy army paratrooper. But the first date we went on was she went pheasant hunting with me. she's a hunter, but she just rejoiced in walking in the meadows.
It was
October of 1973. I remember it just so vividly. Walking in a field and the pheasants jump up and she covers her ears, and of course I didn't. That's why I've got problems to this day. But what a deeply gratifying thing. We got that as one of our fondest memories, that time going up. But my dad passed that down to me. My dad didn't have a whole lot of time. He worked hard as a grandfather. I've got four grandkids now, two of them grown, one's in the army. But as a grandfather, I have felt like it was my responsibility to take my grandchildren and give them this enormous satisfaction, this enormous opportunity, to pass it on to the next generation. We need to be passionately invested in passing this on, that this way of life should not perish with us. You've got to be passionately invested. And that's what this book is about, is helping people understand and articulate and justify and influence the regulatory process and the conservation process to best enable that bond between us and the dog and the wilderness that creates such joy. Equal, as I said, equal to Christmas.
Yeah.
And
Well,
even there, we're bringing a piece of the wilderness into it.
I love it. You're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden. That's Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, the author of the book On Hunting. And the most important part, but it never fits on the spine, which is, I've learned that the hard way with publishers too. The subtitle, A Definitive Study of the Mind, Body, and Ecology of the Hunter in the Modern World. And we'll get back to that in a moment. I'm just again reminded of that Jose Ortega y Gasset quote, "One does not hunt in order to kill, one kills in order to have hunted." It might be an attitude, it might be a philosophy, as he is a philosopher, but it's also kind of a different way of looking at what we do, isn't it?
It really is. I'm so glad you brought up that. Jose Ortega de Gasset, most of us have never heard of him. I have to admit, I hadn't until I began to do research of this book. And what a deep and powerful and profound thinker that man was. And to be able to preserve that wisdom. All of my books have got great amounts of quotes. I love, for On Killing, On Combat, all my books, I love going through the great books of all time and taking their best lines and weaving it into my book. I think of it as a man talked about it, build me a garden of other men's flowers. But when we began to really take, what are these great bits of wisdom across the centuries? Jose Ortega de Gasset, who just floated to the top. What brilliant language. And you just quoted that most powerful dynamic. It's the joy and the satisfaction and the philosophy that we've got to be able to articulate to some degree, and we've got to become invested in the wellness of the next generation and letting them have this incredible privilege. And we talk in the book about how traditionally only the royalty got to hunt. And if you hunted, you were a poacher, and the sheriff would string you up. Hunting was something that only the wealthy and the powerful could do. And today in this nation, above all other nations around the world, really, we have this incredible privilege and right to go out and to hunt, and we've got to be desperately invested in passing that on to the next generation, both to teach them, taking my grandkids out and giving them that experience, but also just to preserve this way of life and to give them to share that wellness that comes with the process.
We talked a little bit and made a little bit of fun of the vegetarians. I'm reminded of, speaking of quotes, many years ago I interviewed an author named Ted Carasotti, great writer, great author.
Indeed, indeed.
He said in one of his many encounters with anti-hunting vegetarian activist types, there's more blood in your organic granola than there is in my elk that I harvested this year.
It's true.
Which
They say,
it's a head scratcher until you think about what you alluded to, whether it's the mice in the grain bin or the raccoon who ends up going through the combine with corn, or all the pheasant chicks that are, eradicated by, the truck going down the highway. All those things carrying the organic granola. So, but that makes me think about a little, the encounter that we have once in a while, and it starts with that, or it ends with that, or with somebody stomping out. You contend in the book that anti-hunters need hunters. Why is that?
Well, it's the balance of society, the need for us to have people out in the wilderness doing what we do. We represent the healthy part of our civilization. We represent the people who are preserving the wilderness and investing in conservation, influencing regulatory processes. Without that, we would all be, lesser human beings. I don't know. What do you think? What did you get out of that part? It was a critical part on that dynamic of why they need us. Did we articulate that well enough?
Yeah, and I'm a professional arguer. I worked in
Yes.
politics. So, that kind of just, okay, yeah, sure. That's like a red flag. I'm going to come right over there, a shiny, bright,
Yes.
shiny object, so that I can argue with somebody about it. But I think it goes deeper than that, and that the world is always contrasts. We need a yin and we need a yang.
Yes,
And all of
yes.
those things fit into this idea without going too deep into it. But what would you, from a practical standpoint, we run into these people, whether it's somebody in the grocery store or some guy throwing red paint on a fur coat. What do you have any advice for those of us who have to encounter these
I do, I do.
anti-hunters? Yeah.
Let's think about that for a minute, though. You've probably heard it. Many have heard it. It's a good little line. If you haven't, some of you might get a kick out of it. But, vegetarian is an old Native American word that originally meant bad hunter. And when we talk about this, let's kind of start at one pole. Now, you would not have thought of comparing pheasant hunters with trophy hunters. Well, let's go ahead and move out to that pole. We talk about the Namibia versus Kenya model.
Okay.
And Kenya has banned all trophy hunters,
Right.
and their game is being slaughtered. The locals are killing game for food. They can't afford game wardens, so poachers are slaughtering them. Now, Namibia has drawn a circle around every village and said everything in this circle belongs to you. So that crazy American who will pay $100,000 to kill that lion. Now, first off, understand that lion is at the end of his life cycle. And death by old age in nature is a slow, hideous, horrible death. Now, when you die of old age, if there's a predator there, the predator will eat the soft, gooey parts first while you're in agony, but give you a reasonably quick death. If you don't have a predator there, the rodents and insects will eat you alive across a period of days while you slowly die. It's a horrible death. So we get a quick ethical death. Everything, the money and the hide and the meat goes to the locals, and we preserve there. And they're just fighting mad over anybody that tries to get in the way of this way of life that they have discovered in this niche with nature and wildlife, and they've got poachers. I mean, they've got game wardens who are intensely dedicated to protecting all of their game. This is all possible by these trophy hunters coming and giving them this ethical death at the end of the life cycle. So nature will eat those pheasant chicks happily. The fox, the feral cat, they will eat that nest full of pheasant chicks in their youth. We're hunting them in their prime. And very often it's the slowest one up that gets taken. It's really very often it's the one at the end of the life cycle again. But we harvest these it when they're mature adults. Nature will eat the chicks, and like you said, the combine will take that whole nest full of chicks and grind them up and mix them up with your granola. But we're careful hunters. We preserve. We wait until it's the right season when it's most effective. Not during, not when they're nurturing chicks and young. It's at that time of year when we don't even think about why we hunt in the fall. But that's the time of year that if you take that pheasant down, there's no chicks that will starve. There's no downside. This is the ideal time to harvest them. We don't even think about the fact that the time of year that we hunt is all about doing the very best job of preserving them and harvesting them at just the most appropriate time. I think we can articulate that we're the ones that are putting our hunting license is going in the money that we spend at the for the gear that we have, all of that's part of that equation of us being able to justify who we are. And the first step is just to justify in your own heart, in your own mind. It's so easy sometimes to say, well, maybe that guy's right. You know, we kind of shuffle back. Now, you're a professional arguer, but not all of us are. So we need to be given that number one, that deep, powerful sense that this is right, that I'm right, that you can deeply and totally justify who I am and what I do. And then to be given you the ammo, if you will, to be able to turn around. And even if you don't personally, you just nod and you move on. Most of us are in your heart, you know the answer, and you're able to articulate it to that next generation. There's so much on the line right now. And for this book to be able to fill that gap. Hey, and a quick aside on this too. I've done the narration on six audiobooks, six of my books. We did the narration on this one. I have two other wonderful, wonderful co-authors, amazing people. And there's an outtake reel. It's the best audiobook we've ever done. And it's got an outtake reel that will just, you'll get a hoot on. If you ever done an audiobook, if you thought about maybe starting an audiobook, you know, a lot of people sitting up in the deer stand will listen to an audiobook, or on a long drive, they'll put in an audiobook. If you ever thought about it, this would be a good place to begin, because it's really quite a hoot. Both the book, you know, in that form, audiobook is real nice and pleasant when you're driving, doing other things. But then the outtake reel takes it to the next level, and I think a lot of people get a real kick out of it.
No argument there. My editor, my television editor, is a master at capturing that stuff and then throwing it back in my face.
Isn't that fun? That's what the sound is. Yeah. We didn't even know he was doing that. He collected
I love it.
I
love it. Hey, you're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. That's Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, along with Linda K. Miller and Captain Keith A. Cunningham. They put together this book on hunting, a definitive study of the mind, body, and ecology of the hunter in the modern world. We're going to talk ecology in that regard coming up in just a moment. Dave, you get a moment to rest while I make a few bucks here, so hang on.
There you go.
We are brought to you in part by LandTrust.com. Spent some time in the Land Trust booth at Pheasant Fest and was just amazed at how many people said, it's about bleep time, that somebody figured out how to create a VRBO for hunters. And that's not quite exactly the same thing, but the convenience of it is, you go online, you take a look at the properties, you pick one you like, you essentially rent it for a day or several days. Some of them you can camp at, so you're renting it for the night too. It's yours, it's exclusive, it's private land access, it takes the stress out of planning your upland hunt. You can focus on working with your dog, having a good time with your friends, and enjoying the confidence that comes with knowing it's all yours and nobody else's for that day, that 3 days, or as long as you like. I'm already working on another Montana trip with my friends at LandTrust.com, and maybe you should get over there and take a look at what they have to offer. No membership fee. You just open a free account, and then when you book a place, you do it all online. And then it's all yours, all day, all week. LandTrust.com. And, of course, once you get there, you want to shoot straight. And one way to do that is to make sure that you have the best choke tubes you can in your shotgun. My go-to supplier, TrueLockChokes.com. I've told you before, I'll tell you again. You'll shoot better. And what does that mean on a long trip? One more bird in the bag every day? Yeah. They've got a choke tube for just about any shooting activity. Right about now, we're all shooting targets. If you're looking for some good target chokes, they've got them over 2,000 versions of choke tubes, all with a lifetime warranty and a satisfaction guarantee. Plus, there's always an incentive of one sort or another. Save you a few bucks, add some value to your purchase. Go to TrueLockChokes.com. We're spelling that TRULOCK. TrueLockChokes.com. And we're back with Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman. On Hunting is the short title to the book. Dave, welcome back to the Upland Nation podcast.
Oh, Scott, so good to be on board with you. And can we just divert for a minute? on the land trust, landtrust.com, Airbnb for hunters.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of the points that really we want to talk about in the book. If we'd have known about it, we'd have put it in the book at the time. Because those are the kind of things. We live in amazing times. We can bend the technology to our benefit and the benefit of the hunt. It just warms my soul to know there's people out there doing that. Like you said, your little piece of nature that belongs only to you. How brilliant. And that's exciting. We live in remarkable times, and there's good things happening all around us. We just got to go out and grab it.
Well,
but I thought about what you said about. Oh, go ahead, please.
Well,
the land trust.
Capitalism works.
Yes, you know, Churchill said that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others. This is the best we got, guys. This is the best we got. You know, it's the least worst.
The least worst. I like that.
But it works because people like you and all your listeners are in there influencing the dynamics. But I thought about what you said about, you know, missing that bird, that one extra bird. We all know the look. When you miss a bird and the dog looks at you and said, I did my part. That's one of the most powerful communications. The dog looks at you and you missed. He says, hey, he said, I did my part.
Oh, absolutely.
And in so many ways, letting down our hunting buddy, letting down our dog is part of the equation. So I'm 67. I'm still on the road 200 days a year. I train military and law enforcement worldwide. My books are translated in Ukrainian. I'll be going to Ukraine in a month or two to train their military, as I have hundreds of military units during the war and almost every Canadian unit that deployed. And I'm doing great. I'm still in my prime, but my ears are going out. And so I sometimes in the morning, you don't hear the alarm going off. I don't hear somebody knocking on the door. So I've got a deafness dog. I've got a dog who, when the alarm goes off in the morning, he gets in my face, and I got to get up. If somebody's pounding on the door, he gets in my face. And it didn't take much to train him to do that. Every good dog hears the alarm go off in the morning, jumps up and says, let's go. But what I wanted to tell your people is I work a lot with service dog organizations, and a lot of you think that you got to have a $20,000 service dog. And that's a Rolex. There's no problem having a Rolex. No problem selling one, buying one. I had a nephew who was an Afghanistan vet, and he took his life. And if he'd had a dog, it wouldn't have happened. And my nephew needed a Timex. And I just tell people, you need to understand, there's no great dog, there's no great requirement. That companion dog of yours could be your service dog. You can go to Amazon, get a vest, put it on, and you have the legal right to take that dog everywhere. Now, you don't need him in the morning, but he's got to be acclimated, and he's got to be able to interact with community, and that's why you take him with you everywhere. But that's also the great wellness impact for a service dog. The service dog, first and foremost, like dogs are pack animals. You have one dog, leaving it alone at home, it's solitary confinement. But two dogs, right? Two people in a cell, that's good. One person in a cell is torture. We got two dogs, they're fine. Well, we're the same way. We're pack animals. We're not meant to be alone. And when you got that dog with you, it's just something I want to plant a seed. Maybe some of the listeners are in the same situation, are interested about it. Maybe we can talk about it more later. But that incredible wellness that comes from that companionship with that dog is one of the great things that that most people, a joy, a beauty that most people will never know.
Well, most of us have a bond with our dogs that is very similar to a service dog bond. We expect different types of service. And that's what I was attracted to when we talked about this off mic, was how dogs are, you know, they're pretty perceptive critters. And I'm right in the midst of writing an article right now, and it talks about that in particular, but it also talks about something else that you touched on, and that's, you know, how do you build confidence? And especially if you're trying to marshal an argument, a rationale versus a anti-hunter, for example. And I used to, among other things, teach politicians how to be interviewed on television. And, you know, we'd start the session by just shoving a microphone in his face and turning on the lights on the camera. And some would sweat, loosen their tie, and look around, you know, shifty eye look, and they would bobble it. Others were masters at it. They'd spoke, they made eye contact with the interviewer. They spoke in a way that showed that they were knowledgeable of the topic. And that is what the difference became. You're only nervous. You're only freaked out by a red light on a TV camera or by an encounter with some anti-hunter if you don't have the knowledge you need to have.
Oh, that's so well said.
As I don't remember who said it first, but as somebody said, knowledge is power, and it's a power to make an argument. So here we are talking about that sort of thing. And one thing that just stuck out earlier in your book was you described a conflict between hunters and antis, and we've talked a lot about that. But do you have any motivational words for us in that regard?
You know what? One of the things I would tell you is, again, we have been in the middle of the food chain. We have the capacity to survive as prey. You know, we dodged lions and tigers and wolves and other predators for untold thousands of years. We have the capacity to survive as prey. We have the capacity to be predator. The anti-hunters are using their prey neurons. Their mindset is of prey. Their mindset is to hide and run and to stay away and avoid the predator. We have the mindset of the hunter. And the mindset of the hunter is to boldly go out and bring protein home to your loved ones. And to that, it was the hunter. It was not the anti-hunter. It wasn't those who were invested in being prey. It was those who were invested in being successful predators that built every civilization that ever existed. It was those who were able to be the predator, not the prey, who were the great explorers throughout human history. All the good things, exploration, building, civilizations, they all revolve around the people who are exercising the predator neurons. Mm. And God forbid we should have to go to war to defend what we have. Once again, those neurons and those skills are enormously valuable. You know, I train cops. I train all 50 states. I think I'm the only person ever to be post-certified in all 50 states. And I tell them that one of the very best ways to prepare, should you ever have to be fighting for your life, the best way to prepare for combat is to hunt. There's this pile of physiological responses that happen in combat that only happen in hunting, and those are only two places. Now, one of them is auditory exclusion. When a deer hunter shoots or pheasant hunter shoots,
sure,
very often we don't hear the shot. Very often we don't feel the recoil. Now, you are still getting hearing loss, the shutouts in the nerve, wear hearing protection when you hunt, to be deaf old geese like you, it's a pain in the rear. But the only other place where this auditory exclusion occurs is in combat. Now, hunters know about it. They'll talk about it. But how could we have had 500 years of gunpowder combat and not known about that auditory exclusion? You know, when we talk about buck fever, and it happens with first time you bird hunt with a lot of people, it's the first time those predator neurons are actually firing, and you're prepared in the future to a degree that it never was. That first one is important, but there's another angle. My grandson was 7 years old. We took him to deer camp the first time. It could have been pheasant camp. It would have been the same effect. But he came home a week later. He got out of school for a week. He's dirty and grubby. His mom said, "What'd you like the best?" He said, "Gutting the deer." For a seven-year-old boy, what's inside a living creature is fascinating.
I guess so. Yeah,
I've done this with my grandkids. You know, I think of pheasant as being the big game hunting of the air.
Okay,
and they thunder up in front of you, and you bomb, you hammer it, and they drop. But then we gut them and pluck them. And my grandkids, I said, "Look, there's the liver, and there's the heart, and these are the lungs." And he had the same kind of stuff inside of you. And we would take it in case of the deer. We took the back strap off. We slapped it on the grill with some barbecue sauce, and it immediately meant food on the table. So it in the normal cycle of life, somebody would have gone. The kid most able, you know, the youngest kid that could do it would go outside. We needed a chicken dinner. You went outside. You wrung the chicken's neck. You plucked the chicken. You got the chicken. You bring it in, and it was food on the table. Mm-hmm. If the first time you ever experience what's inside a living creature is some terrible accident scene or some horrible crime scene, then we set you up for failure. In the normal cycle of life, you should have encountered what's inside a living creature and know that it means food on the table. It is so dysfunctional, it's so pathological as a civilization that we don't encounter that, all of us, at a young age. So that when that terrible accident scene, that terrible crime scene, or soldiers in combat, if that's the first time you encounter that, then we set you up for failure. And so the hunter is so much more healthy and well-rounded. The hunter is exercising the predator neurons. They are what made the greatness of our species and our civilization. They're exercising those predator neurons. The anti-hunter is hunkered down and invested themselves in the prey neurons. And you got to feel a little pity for them. Got to feel a little sadness. And they didn't have a grandpa that took them hunting. They didn't have a dad that took them hunting. They don't understand, but we do. And we need to communicate that and articulate that and defend that. And it's worth fighting for. I mean, verbally or politically fighting for this wellness that comes down across untold generations of who we are and what we do.
No, I can't argue that at all. Pardon the pun. I know I'm talking about being a professional arguer, but no, I support that. And you know, you said something else, and I'd like you to articulate it in your own words. And that is this idea, you know, of the connection between the hunter and the place we hunt. What's your take on all of that?
Well, you know, again, if you look across history, you know, the Native Americans would talk about their happy hunting grounds. And it was kind of hard to wrap your mind around it, but it was their hunting grounds. But when you die, where you went to, what heaven was hunting grounds, happy hunting grounds. And then heaven was where you would go and fulfill that life. So that piece of land where you hunt and you're intimately familiar with it, it's that the link between man and nature, and you're not plowing up nature. You know, we like, you know, we did a lot of hunting in the grain fields, and you know, they were kicking up the pheasants and the quail and the grouse, where the agriculture was. There was that spill off that made it possible. But we're primarily interested in being in nature as it was meant to be, mm-hmm. as opposed to agriculture that plowed it up. And that's fine. I mean, there's nothing wrong with plowing things up. Nothing wrong with agriculture. It keeps us fed. But we're in tune with nature and the land as it should be. And we're one with the land, and land is one with us. And, you know, we're also much more in tune with the cycle of life. Every creature, you know, we kill, we pick them up, we honor them. We know that they gave their life to put food on the table and for the dog and you to do what gives you joy. And there's a bond with that. And we know at one level that someday we too will be the cycle of life. Now, you know, I wrote the book on spiritual combat. We can take it to the next level on that. But to just be at peace with your mortality, to understand that you're part of the cycle of life, and all things grow and prosper and perish. And the same thing is true with us. And the anti-hunter is fleeing from that. They're fleeing from their mortality. It's so pathological in so many ways.
That leads to what will probably end up being my last question. And I think it's perfectly appropriate to follow with your definition. You, in the subtitle of your book, you talk about the ecology of the hunter in the modern world. Well, most of us, if we learned the word ecology, it was back when they made the flag and everybody was doing the peace sign and wearing tie-dye. But you're talking about something totally different than that. It almost sounds internal. And then the external aspect of it is the modern world. Why don't you elaborate a little bit on that ecology thing?
You know, when we talk about ecology, we talk about preserving wilderness, and we talk about preserving pieces of land, Ducks Unlimited and Pheasants Forever, that the idea of preserving land and preserving wildlife. And again, even the idea of landtrust.com, you'll be able to make a little money off of that land. There's people going to hunt on that land, and they've got it, but you've got money coming back. There is no hope for preserving wilderness and preserving the wildness within ourselves and the wildness without the hunter. Mm-hmm. You know, you, another area would say, why does the anti-hunter need you? Well, there will be no wilderness. If we just we take the lumber and we plant the agriculture and that land serves a function, how can you justify the function of wilderness without the money flowing in from the hunters? It really wouldn't exist. I mean, we're talking vast amount of land that Ducks Unlimited and Pheasant Forever, now the landtrust.com guys that are taking all of these and making it the ecology and the economy are totally interwoven. You can't have ecology without economy. If there's no value in the land, then the land won't continue to exist and wilderness won't continue to exist. The hunter identifies the value in the land, and there's the ecology and the economy are completely interwoven. And when you look at preserving the land, with preserving the ecology and the money to do that, the economics, it keeps coming back to the hunter, who will be the guardian and the protector of the wilderness in the land and the wilderness in our heart. They're totally interwoven.
Well, I couldn't agree more, and that's a great place to cap our conversation, at least this conversation. I have a feeling we'll be talking again somewhere down the road. That's Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, who, along with Linda Miller and Keith Cunningham, wrote the book On Hunting, A Definitive Study of the Mind, Body, and Ecology of the Hunter in the Modern World. Yeah, plenty of room for all of us there in that modern world. It's been enlightening, thought-provoking, and I think you've given us all a little bit more ammunition for the next encounter with somebody who can't figure out why the heck we walk around out there with guns on our shoulder. Keith?
It's been my pleasure, Scott. It's been my
Linda,
honor. God bless you. God bless you.
And then Dave. And I thank Keith and Linda as well, because they put some incredible thought into the book as well. But Dave, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being a part of the Upland Nation podcast.
My pleasure, Scott. God bless.
And don't you go away, because we have some advice on your dog and becoming a better trainer of your dog. Simply, well, one small move is all you need. That and a few other things too, all coming up on the Upland Nation podcast, brought to you by Midway USA. Sign up for the email or text messaging. You'll get 10% off your next order. You need some new gear, clothing. I just got myself a couple new hunting shirts over there. They've got all sorts of ammo this time of year. Who isn't looking for target ammo? Check it out. It's all at MidwayUSA.com. Customer satisfaction is their number one goal. Award winners in that subject area and a whole bunch of others. So check it out. MidwayUSA.com. And sageandbreaker.com is where you stock up on all the things you're going to need for the season. Or if you're like me, you're still kind of cleaning some of your guns from last season. Yeah, everything's in stock, and everything there now has a lifetime warranty. I've been using my brush and pick tool roll kit way more often. Yeah, getting out the crud. You know, you drop a gun, you can't get in there and get that stuff out. Well, you can with the brush and pick tool roll kit. An assortment of various types and various materials. And that's what's important. You got to know the metals that you're going to be using on your gun. It's all at sageandbreaker.com. And one of the things you might want to clean off while you're there is your Hi-Vis sight. Yeah, see what you've been missing. Hi-Vis has magnetic screw attach and plain barrel sights that'll fit virtually every shotgun on the market. And if you need a little help installing it, get on the horn and they'll help you do that. Although most of them are no-brainer. If I can figure it out, you can figure it out. Designed by a shotgunner for shotguns and shotgunners. Hi-Vis-Sights.com. H-I-V-I-Z Sights.com. Well, if you haven't been to Pheasant Fest yet, you should be. Focus next year on Kansas City, early March again. Should be a fun time. One of the things I learned while I was there, I'll be discussing at length very soon with Ronnie Smith and Susanna Love. But right now, let's just touch on one thing I thought, well, I was reminded of for this Handlet segment, and that is how important it is to start your training sessions with a calm, composed dog. You know what the opposite's like. You come home from work and that dog is jumping up, barking, running around, doing circles or handstands, who knows. Well, you're not going to train that dog at all when that dog is as fired up as that. It's just like school. You sat down, the teacher asked for your attention. Maybe they spoke in a soothing voice, but they insisted that you hold still and pay attention. That's the most important part. Lots of ways to do that. Experiment if you need to with speaking softly. Maybe giving them a good stroke. I've told you before, quite often I begin a training session on the whoa table because the dog understands that already. That's where we focus. Do a few, a few familiar drills on skills your dog already knows. Even your praise ought to be soft and subtle. Quiet your training location. Eliminate distractions. And all of that works way better if you've just come off a long, taxing conditioning run. More to come on that subject. Thanks, Ronnie. Thanks, Susanna. In the Handle It segment this week is brought to you by ESP America. Great to see you, Jeff, at Pheasant Fest. Glad you're helping people save their ears, such as it is. Yeah, had a good time learning why people were stopping in and getting a custom fitting right there at Pheasant Fest. And I also learned why ESPAmerica.com hearing protection devices are so much better at eliminating wind noise. First is where the little microphone is on the device itself. Your own ear's anatomy is blocking some of that wind. Now, not everybody does that, and that's the cool part. They've figured that out. The other thing is, ESPAmerica.com, learn about their patented digital software that also helps minimize wind noise. Get all the details and take a look at the assortment of affordable hearing protection devices at ESPAmerica.com. And of course, if you're taking lessons or practicing a lot, hearing protection is even more important. You can do all those things at Mid Valley Clays and Shooting School. Yeah, they've got all the clay target games, including Helis, which I guess technically isn't a clay target game, but it sure is fun. All right there, take a lesson, of course, and remember that Mid Valley Clays is sub-gauge central. Dave Fiedler knows guns and he knows hunting, despite his dog breed choice. Just kidding, Dave. And he would love to counsel with you on your needs in the field, in the range, whether it's a specific gauge, style, ballistics, the brand. Dave's available to you. Get his number at midvalleyclays.com. Call him up, see what he's got available in his gun safes, and then shop hard for or the one that you want most. He'll tell you what you need, offer some suggestions, and if he doesn't have it, he can always get it to you. MidValleyClays.com. Well, thanks, Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman. Enjoying the heck out of your book on hunting, and so will everybody else. Thank you if you commented at our social platforms. Yeah, lots of fun there, and always some thought-provoking discussions. If you left a rating, I appreciate that. And I also appreciate all our fine sponsors, Sage and Breaker, Pointer Shotguns, Purina Pro Plan Sport, ESP America, Mid Valley Clays, Trulock Chokes, MidwayUSA.com, LandTrust.com, and High Viz Shooting Systems. Hey, I hope you are getting to the range, and if you are, maybe I'll see you there. If not, I'll see you at FindBirdHuntingSpots.com. I'm Scott Linden. Thanks for listening to the Upland Nation Podcast.